With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Kata Scott, she was 23 years old. That is Kata right there. Yeah, she worked in elder care, the kind of job that takes more heart than most people will ever give. She was harassed. She reported it. She said she felt unsafe. And the system let her die anyway. 2 weeks after she vanished, her body was found in a shallow grave behind a boarded up middle school in Philadelphia. The man charged with kidnapping her, Keon King. He had already been arrested months earlier for stalking and strangling another woman. Why was he free? Well, that's what we're going to unpack today. The case had surveillance video. It had witnesses. It had enough to prosecute. But the DA, in their infinite wisdom, they dropped it when the victim didn't show up to court. Now DA Larry Krasner says,
"We could have done better."
You think? It's not a lesson learned. That's an admission that the system designed to protect the public simply chose not to. Today, former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis joins us to unpack how this could happen step by step, from the decision not to prosecute to the lack of oversight to the total absence of accountability. Because until we understand where the system broke, we can't stop it from breaking again. Eric, let's start with the decision-making itself as we get into this one. When prosecutors have a prior kidnapping and assault case with video evidence, walk us through this, how this should work and how this did work. How does that even land on someone's desk and get dropped because one witness did not appear? Let's start there.
Sure, Tony. So, kidnapping charges are extraordinarily serious. And on top of that, my understanding is that there were some stalking allegations. Mm-hmm. When I was a prosecutor, that was such a red flag that someone who's willing to go to those lengths to sort of predatorily prowl and seek out their victims over time with repeated contacts, that is a huge signal that something is wrong, that individual is capable of something horrible. When a witness doesn't show up, that's of course problematic. And sometimes the prosecution needs those folks to prove their case. That being said, there are measures that can be taken, including subpoenas, including going to the court and saying a person didn't appear on a subpoena. So there were red flags and there were things that could have been done to try to further that prosecution. It sounds like they weren't done.
I want to understand the rules of the game here. If the witness, the person who is saying I am being stalked, and this person has we know what took place, what the charges are, but she didn't show up to court. Now people could go, well, she didn't show up, then you just dismiss it. Is that how that works? If the person does not show up, it just immediately gets dismissed, no matter what mountain of evidence may exist against the person that's being accused, that has the charges already against them?
Not at all. You know, when we're talking about those kinds of cases, they sometimes need the victim, but there are cases where you have other evidence. Like you said, there sounds like there was video evidence of what happened. Mm-hmm. You don't always need the victim's testimony. Even when the victim does not show up, there are measures that can be taken. In Colorado, if you've subpoenaed that victim and they don't show up, you ask for a continuance of the trial and you have the judge issue a warrant for the victim. It's a harsh measure to take, but it's sort of a last resort to keep the case going. That could have been done. I don't have any evidence that that was done in that earlier case that you're referencing.
No, it makes no sense to me. And I wanted to understand the ground rules first of, you know, if they don't show up, does it automatically just get dismissed? You know, are we getting mad for no reason here? But what you're saying is Krasner, he failed. He had the opportunity to stop this person. He had the opportunity to continue pressing those charges, not dismissing them out into the ether. And it was a decision that was made. It wasn't some sort of policy or rule of how this works. It was a choice that was made by the DA.
From all of the information I reviewed, yes, it appears to be a decision that was made and not some sort of automatic legal outcome that was mandated for that witness not appearing. Like I said, as a prosecutor, you have to subpoena your necessary witnesses. And if it comes to the trial date and you don't have them under subpoena, you can request a continuance of the trial. In fact, you can request multiple continuances to get a witness under subpoena. If you've subpoenaed them and they don't show up, you can still request a continuance and a bench warrant to go out and have a fugitive team find that witness, bring them into custody, and have them present for the next trial. So no, this appears to be just a decision that the prosecutor made rather than some legally mandated outcome.
Stacey?
So my head just keeps shaking here. Like, is this part of a flawed system, or is this... it's just a failure of one person. I mean, and that's a very broad statement to make, but I feel like, and Tony, we talked about this before we went live, like this just keeps happening over and over again. It feels like the system is almost set up for the perpetrator versus the victim. And it should be for the victim. You should be advocating for people who have had things done to them to protect them and to be there for them. At what point do we say the system is flawed? We need to do something better.
Sure. You know, it is a pattern that has repeated, you know, across the country in many criminal cases. And when we're looking at whether a witness shows up, that's a complex issue. You know, there's a lot going on with that witness. They might have reasons they don't want to show up. They didn't ask to be involved in this court process. That being said, in order to ensure community safety and accountability for the alleged wrongdoer, there are measures that can be taken. And so I think it appears to be a function perhaps of sort of the prosecutorial outlook and mindset and strategy in some prosecutors' offices to, you know, I guess kind of move on from a case. They've got a ton of other cases they've got to handle. And so this one, hey, I've got a good reason to let it go. The witness isn't showing up. I'm going to hang my hat on that reason. And then lo and behold, something horrible happens, you know, months down the road.
How often do things like this happen? Because I would think it might be kind of frequent, especially in situations where you have a predator, a perpetrator here, and then you have a victim that's been preyed upon, kidnapped in this case. And for those playing along at home, we're talking about the case prior to Kata Scott that could have stopped this from happening. So just in case you're confusing the two, we're talking about the one that happened before that the DA let go. When you have that sort of a scenario, I can imagine if you're the victim of this perpetrator, you might be a little reluctant to go into court to be seen again, for them to see you again, to have to see them again. I mean, it's re-traumatizing in its own way. So you probably have quite a few, I'm going to guess. I don't know. Is it common where the victim will simply just not show up because they, for fear of their own safety, for fear of what the system may do or whatever their reason may be, out of fear based on what that perpetrator did? And if that does happen frequently, how often is this the outcome where it's, all right, well, they didn't do their part, so we're not going to do ours. And we got, like you just said, there's a big stack of stuff over here we got to deal with, and they showed up and you didn't.
Tony, it's much more common than people realize. You know, when I was a prosecutor, especially at the lower level, the county court level, where we're talking, you know, simple assault cases, oftentimes the victim would be afraid of the perpetrator, sure, would not want to go into court and provide evidence against that person. What if the prosecution loses? What if the defendant wins? He is then free, and this witness who testified against him is in the crosshairs. That being said, although that happens happens frequently. Dropping a case of this magnitude is much less common. You know, if we're talking simple assault, it's, a lot of prosecutors will write it off and say, hey, this is a minor case, I'm going to move on to the next one. When we're talking kidnapping, when we're talking stalking, we're talking these sort of lethality factors that arise in the context of intimate violence and just male on female violence. Usually you go to the ends of the earth to try to find that victim and bring them into court. You request as many continuances as you need. You issue as many subpoenas as you need until the court dismisses it rather than the DA unilaterally deciding, yeah, hey, we're not going to go forward.
Eric, as a prosecutor, did you ever have a moment personally where you knew that dropping a case was going to put somebody at risk? And if so, what do you do? I mean, how do you sleep at night? And I don't want to throw it back on you personally, but there's a human element to this. There has to be. How do you deal with that?
Oh, sure. It's something that's always going through your mind as a prosecutor, because really your duty, in a sense, is to kind of shepherd this community and to make sure that there are no predators out there who are going to hurt the folks in your city and your neighbor and your county. And so it happens all the time. In fact, when I was a prosecutor, there was a time where the defendant failed to appear and the trial had to be couldn't go forward. And I was walking around that courthouse and outside the courthouse looking for that person because I thought I saw him early on in the day. You know, sometimes you have to take it into your own hands and really go above and beyond to try to make these prosecutions go forward despite these hurdles. And I don't have any indication that the prosecutor's office made such attempts.
In something like this, I mean, if you are the victim and you don't want to appear, you're scared. It's ultimately a choice out of fear. And yes, the system has ways of compelling. You just listed a whole bunch of them, you know, all the way to let's, you know, basically we're going to take you into custody and bring you into court. But I mean, that's almost like re-victimizing the victim in right, many ways. What sort of tactics or tools exist, if any, to compel a witness to come in and to feel safe on their own free will, to protect them and let them know, look, you are safe coming in? Or do we very much lack in that area? Are we much more kind of nuts and bolts of they're not here, let's get them here by force rather than let's get them here on their own free will because we are going to protect them and make sure they're safe from this predator that's in the same room as them?
You know, that's one thing, Tony, that sort of soured me on prosecution and caused me to go to the criminal defense side is because, yes, issuing a bench warrant for a victim, my gosh, if they've already been traumatized, then having to be taken into custody and booked into the jail and put into jail scrubs and then testify against the person they're afraid of, that is horrible for that person. And so, you know, you want a good victim witness team. You want to build that rapport. You need to keep the communication going. But what legal mechanisms do we have to protect that victim on the back end? You know, if the defendant's sentenced to prison, well, the defendant is out of the community for a period of time. But usually it's not like they have to wear a GPS monitor for the next 5 years or something. And that victim is always going to be looking over their shoulder. And so that is really a disincentive for those victims to come in and testify. And really, there are all these disincentives and not very many incentives.
You're just adding trauma on top of trauma. So how do you change the system? Can the system be changed to advocate for the victim versus the actual criminal?
You know, it's an important question, Stacey. And, you know, we talk about protective measures like protection orders. And you know, that really on its face is just a piece of paper that says a guy or a person can't contact another person. Those aren't always abided by, of course. We do have GPS monitors, and those can be helpful, but they are not an indefinite, they're not a permanent solution by any means. You know, different prosecutor teams have different victim witness advocates who can explain the process to the victim, try to make them feel comfortable. There are usually local law enforcement that are willing to do higher activity and surveillance in the victim's area as the case is going and after it's going on. But all that drops off at some point, and the victim is left with that fear that, hey, what have I done to this person, and what are they going to do to me now?
Is this another example of just how our system is so antiquated and in every way, shape, and form that we think that this piece of paper is going to hold somebody back? I mean, the same way that we go, well, you signed your name on a piece of paper, that must mean everything. It doesn't, and it doesn't mean anything to these people. Is this something that just really needs to be rethought of in today's terms? I mean, yeah, there's GPS monitors, that's lovely, but then you're relying on that monitor going off when they're in the wrong place, and then you're relying on, I mean, on police getting to them before they commit some sort of crime. It feels like we operate like it's 1895 in so many ways. And look, these pieces of paper, they didn't work then either. but we keep doing them. We keep acting like they mean something.
Yeah, right. And on top of that, you know, GPS monitors can be cut off. I've seen many cases where a person just cuts them off. And then now everyone's really scared. What is that person planning if they don't want to be tracked and they have an ongoing case? You know, I'm not a huge proponent of like increasing oppressive bonds or something like that. But when we're talking about stalking, when we're talking about kidnapping, those folks are usually a danger to the community and should be the community needs to be protected until that individual gets a trial and is either acquitted or convicted. Here, it sounds like this person was just let out, which would be very uncommon in Colorado jurisdictions under these circumstances due to the gravity of the charges and the allegations in the earlier time case.
When you look at the charges here, obviously they're pretty bleak. It's not like a light. That's like a marijuana charge or something like that. It's stalking. It's nuts. It's kidnapping. What on earth? I mean, obviously this is just pure speculation, but what on earth is going through that DA's mind when it's on video that this happened? The victim didn't show up. You've been doing that. I mean, this guy was a defense attorney for a long period of time before he started becoming a prosecutor. He's not like new to this. You would think he understands a little bit about how victim mentality works. I mean, he was a civil rights civil rights attorney for a while. You would think that someone of that mindset would have the grace, the understanding of a victim and wouldn't be so quick to just drop a case like this. What on earth was going through his mind at that moment to think, oh, well, let him go? That's the part that baffles me, other than, I don't know, complete, utter distraction of something else in one's life. This just doesn't make sense to me.
You know, it is certainly puzzling. I think some critics will say that this is a function of what are called or would have been termed progressive prosecutors. And I think that prosecution needs to change. I think there needs to be changes in prosecution. On the other hand, we can't go so far in the other direction that we are overlooking obvious risks to the community, obvious risks to actual victims here. And yet, when you have that stalking charge, that was one thing that was drilled into me as a prosecutor, is that is a red flag. That is a person you need to watch in this community, because they are hunting, according to the allegations, they are hunting other human beings in your community. And so the decision to just kind of let him go free and whatever, especially when it's on video, there are ways to prove cases without victims, without witnesses, when you have that other kind of evidence. And so I'm surprised they didn't try a creative approach, even perhaps a lesser charge. If they didn't think they could prove the most serious charges without the victim, there are lesser charges that can be pursued that could at least provide some safe haven for a period of time for that community.
Does fear of losing a trial push prosecutors to play it safe instead of playing it right in something like this? Meaning, well, this witness is already really reluctant. Maybe they have some knowledge of this and they really feel like, well, they're probably not going to participate. So why even spend my time on this? I mean, is it, you know, I don't want to have this on my track record of, you know, this didn't work out for me. This isn't going to be one that's going to look good on my record. So I'm just going to push it out here so it doesn't ding it that way. I mean, it's purely bureaucratic, but I wonder, you know, does that exist in the system with some prosecutors?
You know, nearly every person has some degree of an ego. And for lawyers, that's like times 100. And even especially for criminal lawyers, especially for prosecutors who are in the public eye, like Larry Krasner, there is certainly, I would imagine, a motivation to not want to have that L on your record, especially on a high-profile case. And so if the case is dismissed, that's much different because purportedly that they couldn't get the victim's cooperation. That's much different than going to trial and actually suffering that loss. And so sometimes prosecutors kind of cherry-pick. They pick and choose which cases they think are strongest and most likely to lead to a win. And sometimes that's a valid approach, but yeah, certainly I've got to wonder whether those personal considerations could have contributed in some form or fashion to the decision the prosecutor made, and if so, that's probably not a valid factor on which to either dismiss or move forward with a prosecution.
Are there any checks and balances in this system where if you have a prosecutor that makes a move like this? I mean, could there have been anyone in that office that when these charges were dropped that said, wait a second, let's take a look at this again. This doesn't make sense. Or once that decision is made, that decision is made. And then there's no consequences for that decision for the person that makes it.
There's really no good legal mechanism by which such a decision could be challenged. If the prosecutors have what's called prosecutorial discretion, which really means, hey, they get to decide which cases they like and want to go forward on and which one they don't. And when they make that decision, you know, the judge can't say, hey, I disagree with dismissing this case. I'm going to force you to move forward on it. You could see sort of the problems that could arise with that because of you're compelling a prosecutor to move forward on a case they don't like. They might not try that hard. It might not be a successful prosecution. But, you know, should there be some other kind of mechanism where the victim could petition the court, could ask for a substitute prosecutor? You know, these are ideas that have been considered.
Is there ever a point where a prosecutor could face charges themselves for negligence in this, like in this case?
In many states, there is such robust immunity for governmental actors, including prosecutors, in the decisions they make, especially when it comes to their own discretion, because they're going to come up with sure. reasons that sound valid no matter what. You know, typically you can't sue a prosecutor. You know, sometimes they'll try to sue police departments for not pursuing a crime or a person that they had evidence against. But even those are really difficult to win. You know, I think there's a problem with how broad prosecutorial immunity is. And I've actually sought to try and change that in Colorado. But that's a work in progress across the country.
Do you think there would ever be progress on that? I mean, obviously, you know, you're kind of like it's an uphill battle, I would imagine, to try and fight that one, because I would, you know, anybody in that community certainly, you know, benefits from that protection. And rightfully so in many cases. There's you don't want just a bunch of frivolous lawsuits going against prosecutors that somebody disagrees with for grounds that make no sense. But at the other side of the coin, you have these sort of situations that go on every day. What is the solution? What is the healthier middle ground rather than just constantly swinging way over here or way over here when reality tends to be more in the middle?
You know, it's a tough issue to navigate. One thing that's come about recently is trying to impose some kind of accountability on prosecutors' discretion when they are grossly negligent. And that includes whether they go forward on a case that's bogus or whether they choose not to go forward on a case that is legit and then something horrible happens. You know, they've talked about possibly having attorney's fees and costs be imposed against prosecutors when they go forward on a bogus case. And I'm just wondering if there's some kind of corollary on the reciprocal where they choose not to go forward on a serious case and then something bad happens. And you know, hitting the pocketbook is always can move the needle. You can get traction there. But really, those ideas are in their infancy. And legislatively, that there is just not much of a political appetite for that kind of thing.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.